Oh, yeah. Well, I would like to thank a number of people. Certainly, this is not kind of work that you do alone. When you start getting into using UAS for the purposes that we're going to be talking about here, this is something that requires a lot of different people and a lot of different skills. Right now at the University of Minnesota, we have a collaborative work going on with aerospace engineering. They're working on everything from machine language through the design of UAS. We're doing the entomology portion of it, so it actually all kind of comes together. A number of years ago, we started looking at site-specific management for a number of insect pests. My particular interest is in colonization. And as John said, you end up with aggregated populations for a number of different reasons. The one I'm interested in is how do insects start to colonize fields and how do the populations start from there. We did work with green peach aphid and a number of other aphids which vector PVY into sea potato fields, which is a very important issue in sea potatoes. And what we found was that they establish on the edges of the edges of the fields first. They maintain there for about 2 weeks, say 14 days, before they start moving into the field. Gives you a nice two-week window that you can do a border treatment, target your application. And what we found over time was, yeah, you get the same control for 17% of the pesticide, worked extremely well. There was a problem with this with regard to site-specific management, though, and precision ag. Where we're going is real-time precision ag. This was not real-time. It took about 16 hours to 16 man hours to actually establish what the population was. We had to do it twice a week. And that's not real time. And afterwards, of course, there's a lot of analysis. To make site-specific management work, it's not just a matter of you have to know where they are. You have to do it in a relatively timely fashion. And if you're thinking about the temporal efficiency of this, if you're going to map one research field and it's going to take 16 man hours, those were about 40-acre fields, and a crop scout's trying to complete about 15,000 acres in a day, and he's using a four-wheeler, the numbers don't add up. Right? You need to have a much more rapid way of assessing what those populations are. And, of course, one of the ways we decided to look at was canopy reflectance. We've been looking at this for a number of years, but when we first started seeing UAS come up, it just seemed to be a beautiful way for these things to come together. Now, if you think about crop reflectance, insects damage plants the same way that any other stressor does. You see a response in pigments, you see a response in the internal leaf structure. So the canopy reflectance is going to mirror this. There's some plant geometry which is going to come into this as well, the orientation of leaves and the distribution of damage. Mostly, though, what we're seeing is, of course, and this is my bread to the baker's slide, you see stress plants reflecting more red, and you see them reflecting a lot less near IR. The near IR is a result of the damage to the palisade cells, and the decrease in red is because you're having a decrease in chlorophyll. So UAS actually started, we started thinking about, okay, we're running around, we've used green seekers for a while, we've used boom images, we've used a number of different ways of trying to assess what that canopy reflectance is and finding those locations of stress within a field. We started thinking about drones. Actually, what made me start thinking about drones was one of my technicians is a pilot, and we were looking at, he was showing me a YouTube of a drone that they were taking a picture of a beautiful wedding on a beach, and they were using a drone to get circling over the, many of you have probably seen this, it's gone viral, circling the couple, and then it comes straight up and smacks the bride right in the face. And I immediately thought, that has potential. So we started thinking about, we've used satellite imagery for a long, long time. There are some issues with it. We've used airplanes, and then we have the guy on the ground. What UAS provides us is a platform that fills a gap. It fills the gap between airplanes and between that guy on the ground. The guy's on the ground, and as he's crossing across the ground, he probably has a visual reference sight of maybe 12 feet on either side of him. Okay, so he's in the middle of a 12-foot radius as he's traveling along, and he's not going to hit the whole field. He's going to have to sample certain areas in it. Satellite on the other end of the spectrum, yeah, it takes a big footprint. miles across, but the resolution is relatively small. The guy on the ground has very high resolution. Airplanes, they have fairly good resolution, but they're expensive to operate. And unless you're like this technician of mine who happens to be a pilot, you've got to hire somebody to do it. And so UAS allows you to kind of fill this platform somewhere between the two. It's also a lot more current. You have a satellite that flies over, it's cloudy, you're not getting data that day. You can't call NASA up and say, can you send that thing back tomorrow? It's supposed to be nice. But you can take a UAS out and do it. You could do it with an airplane as well, but it's much more costly. So it's just a way of kind of filling it in. The units that we're actually using are, we try to use units that are because we have, we're a very applied lab, we have a large extension responsibility, we're trying to use equipment that's basically available to the grower now. Because growers are using this technology now. If you have a meeting and you start talking to growers, actually ask them, how many of you own a drone? You'll be amazed at how many hands go up in the audience. The flip side of that is there's not a lot of research to support the decisions and recommendations that are being made about the use of this technology. So that is a real gap in our research. So we're using things like 3D robotics as a nice little unit out. It's called an Iris. It flies very small, things like a GoPro. We use a DJI S-1000. That thing is much larger. It's an octocopter. It has a much heavier payload. But these things are still limited in their flight time. They're great for research because we can hover over a plot. But realistically, from an applied viewpoint, they're probably going to be using fixed ones. The sensors that we use mostly are modified cameras that can see into the near infrared. But we do use visible as well. And I'll give you an example of that today. You can get data from both of them. Everybody here probably has got a near IR sensitive camera in their pocket. Every digital camera is sensitive to about 1100 nanometers up into the near IR. It's just that they filter out that to keep your picture from getting a little fuzzy. You can actually go in and aftermarket modify the cameras, remove the near IR filter, put in different filters, and it basically allows you to be sensitive to near IR as well as green and or blue or red light. So we use a number of these modified cameras, including both a visible GoPro and a modified IR GoPro. The units themselves are very interesting. The technological advancements that are coming along in these things is just phenomenal. The GPS systems on the birds themselves use a very advanced signal-to-noise ratio algorithm, and it really optimizes their positioning. And usually the salespeople say, we're accurate to about one to two meters. And actually, operationally, it's fairly close to that. It's probably closer 2 to 3, but it's not bad. This also could have something to do with the fact that much of my work is done in Minnesota. Here, it's extremely flat. We get a lot of satellite reception and GPS. As one of my friends say, Crookston, where we're doing a lot of this research, it's extremely flat. You can watch your dog run away for about 3 days. So, with regard to precision ag, the sensors that we're using are actually more accurate than what the application equipment is right now. The sensors are, sometimes centimeter, sub-centimeter accurate, especially depending on what altitude you're flying. The cameras themselves, the Tetracam, which is an agricultural purpose-built camera, is about 1.3 megapixels, but that Sony, the modified Sony we fly, is a 16-megapixel camera. Now, there's also trade-offs on that. If you're using a fixed-wing vehicle and you're moving, you probably want something that's got lower resolution so you don't get as much blur. The technology is extremely advanced. Most of these things have autopilots in them. They usually you just set it via Google Earth, give it waypoints, it'll follow the waypoints. The nice thing about it is it also downloads telemetry data, so you can actually use the telemetry data on that on the vehicle to locate your geo-coordinate your images. The problem with that is that sometimes the wind comes up, and the vehicle is doing this. You do have a stabilized gimbal trying to keep that camera pointed straight down, but there might be a little bit of lag on that. So we actually use accelerometers and small GPS units that we actually attach to the stage of the gimbal to make sure that we've got a double check on the telemetry data that we're using. compensates for the pitch and roll and yaw of the vehicle. Now, as you kind of advance across the field and you're taking these different images, they have to be stitched together into one large image so that you can have a much easier time, a lot more fun with the image analysis rather than analyzing, you know, 100 and some odd images. You just image one, which means you have to stitch them together. There's a number of software programs, but we also use these GPCs, ground control points. Each one of those plates has a unique pattern on it. It allows the software to recognize the pattern, helps to tie those things together and build your mosaic quite easily. The whole concept really does facilitate kind of building up those multiple images into one large one. The higher you fly, the better your resolution, but there are FAA regulations, and that is the 800-pound gorilla in the room right now, is if you're going to do this, you have to make sure that you're hopping through the FAA regulation hoops, and they are multiple right now. Hopefully changing. Does it work? Yes. From reflectance viewpoint, we've had very good luck on things like soybean aphid. This is the work of Tavis Alves, who's sitting over here, is a graduate student. He's looking at trying to coordinate reflection with reflectance with soybean aphid. This is from one of our first publications. And yes, we do have a positive or a very strong relationship between both NDVI and RED and cumulative aphid days. It's also worked on things like sugar beet root maggot. We've looked at these populations. These are two near IR images. This was actually, I think this is ground, but we do have aerial imagery as well. The high root maggot populations were, the bottom picture was from plants in a high root maggot population plot, the top from one that had no root maggots. And you can see there's a much higher spectral reflectance in that low root maggot population. Perhaps the one that I'm finding most interesting is defoliation. Now, this is one you can actually use visible data on. The way that defoliation is usually used as a treatment threshold is you get a lot of people, like, takes a long time, you're out there, you're doing visual observations, and of course, so this is a job we make undergraduates do. But what if you could actually fly that field and calculate what your defoliation was in minutes rather than taking an hour and going through all of your plots? Well, it's possible. We've actually taken both near IR and visible imagery, and it's you just fly it over, you stitch it up. We're using Agisoft, which is a very nice piece of software, which is very good for mosaicing. I can recommend it. And then it's just a matter of calculating out the canopy segmentation. With most of the software, this is going to be a supervised classification. It's basically training the software to recognize vegetation versus non-vegetation areas. And so you're highlighting those areas that are non-vegetation. The software will actually go through and it will start to calculate out what that vegetative area is. And what you're basically doing is calculating out what your defoliation rates are. We've done this with both near IR and visible data. It's a really very accessible technique, and we've had extremely good response with it. And frankly, when you compare, you do correlations on the ground observed estimates of defoliation and the image calculated ones, they're very, very similar. And in fact, some of the R-squareds and some of our new ones are much higher than this. So works extremely well. Some caveats. I've already mentioned the FAA. You have to make sure, buy spare parts. What goes up comes down. In fact, sometimes in a fiery, spectacular manner. In this case, these are all electrical driven vehicles. Ours are. They're using LiPo batteries. When the airlines tell you, make sure you don't put those LiPo batteries in your luggage when you're on your way out, believe them. This thing caught fire in the air. It was a bad sell. The battery started to catch fire, and our pilot's sitting there thinking, you know, it's not gas-powered. Why is it smoking? We were lucky. It actually came down in a wheat field. We're lucky it wasn't drier. So we're lucky it was green when it came down. So a lot of different things to think about. Wonderful tool. The technology is advancing so rapidly that everything I've shown you is obsolete now. It's changing that quickly. It really is. So, time for questions?
We have a question for Ian.
Yeah?
With the software that does the mosaicing of the small footprint, and working with that step with either satellite or man, mm-hmm. given your flight path, mm-hmm. some angle direction changes.
Yes, it does.
Is hiding in that software that fixes that problem? Your mosaics look good, but when you start to do analyses, that aspect, mm-hmm. that angle,
yep.
can come up and get you. So what's different with you UAS guys than some of the others?
Well, couple of things. You try to minimize whatever angle you're going to do by always, you know, all of our stuff is taken at solar zenith. I mean, we're taking our flights, same as anybody else, we're taking our flights between 10 and 2, you know, so we minimize as much shadow as we can. Yes, you're correct. If you come back, you may have that. One of the ways to do that is to come back and start again when you're going down. The altitude at which you fly decreases some of it. We fly a lot lower. As a matter of fact, one of the things that is problematic in using these in aviation is the fact that there's a lot of other airplanes up there in aviation. And up in Minnesota, we have a huge industry in pesticide application. You know, so aerial applicators are huge. It's the only place I've ever been where they send them up in squadrons. So these guys are ferrying at anywhere between, say, 200 to 400 feet, so they're around that 300-foot level. FAA allows you to fly up to 400 feet right now. The proposed rulemaking will take it up to 500, but that's probably not a good idea because it puts you right in the same area when they're ferrying. And so actually, I like to fly below treetop level. So we keep our data collection at about 40 meters, no higher, oftentimes 30, and that also corrects it a little bit. So time frame is quite a lot lower because we're doing one field at a time. We're actually looking for a smaller footprint. Time of day when you're taking it to compensate for those sun angles, and also the fact that you're at a much lower altitude. All of that helps, but there are some tricks that you need to kind of look at. Yeah.
Another question over here.
Yep.
One question about what kind of details you get about insects like aphids or root maggots? Do you get number or?
No, and that's. No, and that's something, that's a good point. I should have mentioned this. We're not actually looking at counting the insects themselves. We're looking at trying to associate a reflectance value with a population level. All right, so we're actually looking at the damage. We're trying to categorize the amount of damage that we're getting and associate that with a particular population level.
To give some idea about the aphids getting underneath the leaves?
Well, with aphids, you're not going to be counting number. What you're hoping for is looking at trying to associate a particular value with in the reflectance of the canopy with a population level that's associated with a particular damage. We know what level of damage we can expect from certain population levels, and in fact that's why we use things like cumulative aphid days. And what we're trying to do is tie that reflectance value in with cumulative aphid days. Well, that's what we're aiming at. Right now, very difficult to do. The other thing that we're working on, and Zach Marston, who's another graduate student in our program, is working on, is trying to differentiate. And that's something we can't do right now either. We can't differentiate between stressors. And that's an important thing for growers to realize, because many of them are being told something else. So.
So that's great for you.
Thank you.